The 2023 operating budget for Niagara Regional Police Service is a matter of discussion, to say the least, on the Niagara Regional Anti-Racism Association agenda. Saleh Wazirudin is here with us today to talk about it. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing okay, Carl. Thanks for having me on, Shivoli. And as you said, I'm Saleh Wazirudin from the Niagara Region Anti-Racism Association. It was a long night for anyone watching that meeting, I guess. Were you watching the meeting too?
I didn't catch the meeting, which is why I was hoping to talk to you about your thoughts. I know you've talked to a couple of my colleagues, but I'd love to get your reflections on what happened.
Well, I'm glad at least one of the counselors brought up our letter. Laura Yip brought up our letter about that it would be fiscally irresponsible, and actually socially and morally irresponsible, for the council to not ask the police to come back with a different budget where they shifted mental health and welfare check calls away from themselves to another service. And the objections that come up, the police chief answered them himself, actually. He said that a mental health crisis is a medical crisis, and medical professionals should be the one to respond. And he said, literally, we're happy to see calls where there's no threat to public safety go to EMS, and they're already talking with EMS to identify those calls. But then he raised an objection that EMS is already backed up with a hospital backlog, but we're not just talking about shifting the calls, we're also going to talking about shifting the money as well. So that should take care of that. And instead, the council seemed to spend a lot of time on $200,000 surplus they have from last year, which they also didn't, in the end, end up decreasing from the police. But this is a much bigger fish to have the calls that don't need to be answered by the police answered by the right service. And it's actually a matter of our lives, because this happened last year where there's a black Port Colborne man killed by police. He had a knife, but the Special Investigations Unit said that, the report said that, they realized he had quote-unquote cognitive deficits. So you have a professional who can deal with that. They can talk him down. Instead, if you respond to a knife with a gun, you have an unnecessary killing.
Yeah, and I don't want to, again, I don't want to be unfair to the officers that are out there trying to do work. And I never want to imply that police work is easy by any stretch of the imagination. But other police forces are doing things differently. And I'm not sure if you've been able to enter into the dialogue that maybe Niagara Regional Police Service could try some things that other police services are doing.
That's right. I mean, this isn't something new or something unheard of. In Edmonton, they reduced the police operating budget by $11 million over 2 years. And the way they did that is to shift it to a community and well-being bureau, they call it. But basically, it's the same idea, to shift it to civilian service. So this is something the police are already meeting with the EMS about. So it shouldn't be that difficult, actually, to ask the police to come back with a number that will match calls that they could give to the EMS. I think it's going to be better for everybody, and that the counselor should spend more time on that than the $200,000 surplus from last year.
I think that's fair. There's a couple areas that I want to go down, drawn from your letter, and I think before I ask you, you've done a bit of a breakdown of the different types of calls that the Niagara Regional Police Service listed from their 2020 annual report. But before we go there, I mean, you mentioned right at the top of the letter that in the January 12th budget meeting, the regional councillors made a point about being fiscally responsible, yet this budget is going to increase. Can you talk about that a little bit?
The regional councillors keep talking about how their voters and constituents and residents are telling them that they can't take hikes in their property taxes, and that they don't feel they're getting value for what they're paying. Well, this is one area where that's definitely the case. Like, why are we sending police in cases where the police chief himself says there's no threat to public safety? There is a complication the police chief says where it's hard to figure out. It may be hard sometimes to figure out when that's the case, but other times it's not. So, you know, if they're talking about fiscal responsibility, even to the extent where they've casualized three call center employees are going to add from being permanent to being temporary, even though it's not going to save any money, and the calls are not going to drop to zero for, according to staff, if they're going to that extent, then they need to go at least look at have the police look at reducing the calls they're responding to, which, you know, again, the police chief himself said it better than I could, that they're happy to let those go to EMS.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that the calls go to the most appropriate service providers at the time when they're coming. You did break down, and you provided a little bit of data in the letter. Can you talk to us about the data in the letter?
Yes, sure. So this is from the 2020 annual report from the police, which is the latest one on their website. I don't know what happened with the 2021 report. So this is from 2019, before COVID, and the welfare checks, mental health Act calls, and then they have another category called welfare check and non-urgent. That seems like that definitely should not be from the police, from mental health or social workers. Those calls were number 3 of all the calls, number 12 and number 16. That's 11,000 calls out of 131,000, or about just under 8.5%. I mean, welfare checks were number 3 at 5,500 calls. And the non-urgent ones were 2,212, and mental health were 3,312. So these are lots of calls. Some counselors have said that if you take money away from the police when you call the police, they won't be there to respond. Actually, that's not the case here. We're talking about taking money away and the calls away that the police don't need to respond to, and that the police chief himself has rightfully recognized that a mental health call is a medical call and should be dealt with a medical service. So about 8.5% of all the calls, that's a pretty big chunk. And I'm not saying all of them don't have public safety at risk, but definitely it's been recognized by what the police chief said last night that some of them definitely do.
I mean, it's a math-based argument. I mean, if there is a double-digit or an almost double-digit percentage, or at eight, just almost 8.5% of the calls. Sorry, if there's 8.5% of the calls, then shouldn't a chunk of the budget be reallocated to account for that? What kind of a reception to sharing these numbers have you gotten when you've presented this information?
Well, I didn't hear back on this. There's a bigger picture issue here. You know, with the Edmonton Police, City Council, when the report was sent to them, about saying that about 32% of their calls didn't need to be answered by the police. The cover page of that had just two words, and those two words were "believe us." And I think that's the problem, that we're not being believed, even though we're using the police's own numbers. But there's a reluctance to listen to BIPOC, racialized people, and ourselves, the Niagara Region Anti-Racism Association, on this issue, even though the police chief basically made the same argument. The police board has said that the police are dealing with things that are social problems they're not supposed to be dealing with. They shouldn't be dealing with. These should be social solutions to those social problems and funding for those social solutions. But it seems like there's a reluctance. They didn't even go so far as to take away the $200,000 surplus from last year that carried over. So there's a lack of depth here. And we're not being believed, I think, is really the issue.
I think that's what's tough, and the reason why I wanted to talk to you directly today is that I'm not sure that enough of our listeners know that as two non-white individuals, that the way that police present in our respective communities is I think sometimes seen differently. And I'm not saying, you know, all white people, and I understand that officers, there's diversity in the police force and everything like that, but the idea of an officer showing up tends to represent different things in different communities. And when someone is having a distress call, if a non-white person is having a distress call and a police officer shows up in any of the communities that I've ever worked directly with, and including with my friends in Indigenous communities, that it doesn't necessarily present as something that's going to make the situation safer. Is there any comprehension of that on any level in conversations that you've had?
Well, I think a couple of years ago, you, as well as myself and several other people, many of them BIPOC, Indigenous, one Inuit person, a Black woman. We all spoke about exactly that issue. And I don't think the council was listening to us, regional council, because they didn't support really many of the reforms that were proposed. And it's easy for an official like the police chief to just say something and be believed, but we are not believed. And actually, the police chief's own words, if you look closely, as I mentioned, they support what we're saying, they support our argument. So it just takes a little bit of questioning, a little bit of critical thinking, a little bit of willingness to listen to BIPOC people, what we're saying, to get to the truth here. I mean, wouldn't that you say that was your experience from a couple of years ago when you spoke at regional council, that you know they were interested in what you were saying, but it didn't translate into actual policy changes?
I'd say that's safe. I'd say that across the board, a lot of us in the summer of 2020, when we all collectively mourn the loss of life of George Floyd at the hands of police, a lot of people had a lot of appetite for reform. And I don't know that the needle has moved in 2 years, 2.5 years now. I don't know if you've seen any substantive changes on the levels that you're advocating on. Have you seen any changes?
The only there's a partial demand of ours, the Niagara Region Anti-Racism Association, that was met by the police, which was for hate crimes. They used to say, well, there's 20 hate crimes last year, or 19. But for any other crime, you could find out from a website when and where and what happened and who it happened to and so on. So they've met our demand on that, where for 2020, 2021, they published the details of, you know, which protected group was targeted, what was the crime, where did it happen, what city, when. That's the only thing. Under the Ontario Anti-Racism Act of 2017, the police forces are required to collect use of force data by race and publish those. And when those came out, we can see there's a big problem, because in 2020, nearly a quarter of the use of force was against Black people. But at the time, are less than 3% of the residents here. So there is a big disparity. But there's still a big appetite for change. There was one conference call, I think, with the police, where the police chief or a police official, ward official, said that they're not hearing an outcry for body cams, but there actually is a big appetite for having body cams and for some of other demands, like dropping racial profiling, now called collection of identifying information. I think the appetite for change that was there 2 years ago is still there, but very little has been met. And I've said that a lot of the ways it's being addressed is PR, because if there's talk but no action, that's not change, that's PR.
I have to ask you, since you brought it up, I mean, you wrote an op-ed or you wrote a local article in for the weekly papers, and you talked a little bit about carding and how we do have some Toronto-like statistics when it comes to the disproportionate way that racialized people are affected by the actions of police. Can you talk a little bit about that article that you wrote?
Yes, it was an op-ed for the Niagara Dailies, and you know we're worse than Toronto. Actually, in Toronto, when the use of force data was coming out, the police chief told all his officers, you know, brace yourself, this is going to be really bad. And when the data came out in Niagara in the May board report, where actually we're 1.5 times greater disparity. More disproportional for police use of force against Black people. So we're worse in Toronto. There was no such comment of brace yourself, or there's no shame, there's no embarrassment. You know, it's sometimes this is described as dishonesty that there's a racism problem, but I think it's worse, it's dishonesty that the numbers themselves are showing that not only we have a problem where there's disproportionately use of force against racialized people, but it's actually worse than Toronto, where they're doing something or they're recognizing it as a problem. Same with Peel, by the way. There's reforms for the Peel and Toronto police, but none for Niagara, and the stats show that it's actually worse here.
how important is it then and so we're able to have this data because this is one of the pushes and the products that came from some of the changes. So at least having this data, even if it hasn't been brought to the public light at the same level as say Toronto and say other areas, how important is it at least to know and to have the numbers in front of us?
Well, a big problem has been that we haven't had the data, I mean, not just in general, but especially in Niagara compared to Toronto or Peel, Brampton. So this is really important to actually get a start. We're still missing some data. In fact, some of the people criticizing my op-ed said that, well, we don't know the other stats of, what was involved or what in those use of force incidents. But in Toronto, they did actually a very deep dive where they cross-referenced all the different data, and they found that the only explanation of the disproportionality of use of force was race. They even looked at, like, was a gun involved, what part of town was it in, and what was the income level of the area, and the only thing that explained it was race. So this is a start. We're also asking not just for use of force to be tracked by race, but also traffic stops, who gets stopped, who actually gets charged. These are things that BIPOC committee members are telling us there's an issue of, but we haven't had the data to prove it. And it's disappointing sometimes because there was even a St. Catharines City Council meeting on police reform where one councillor said that he had talked to neighbors who told him that there is disproportionality by race, and that he was going to vote to ask for police to have reforms on that, but then in the end he didn't. So even there, we're not being believed, and the data is backing us up. And so we definitely, it gives us more of a leg to stand on.
I appreciate you talking with us and talking about how in other territories, it's not postal codes, it's not the type of crime. It's still, unfortunately, the color of someone's skin that's affecting the use of force in these situations. I think we have more work to do, but I'm glad that you took some time for us and to talk to Tim and to talk to Steph yesterday. Thanks for talking to us so much here.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Anytime. As I said earlier, I'm Saul Eliwadine with the Niagara Region Anti-Racism Association. And we posted videos and other things on our socials, which are the NRARA on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. The excerpt from the police chief's presentation that I talked about is on there.
Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.